So I was a typical engineer. I liked working on software. I believed you should be the best in your programming language, the best with your frameworks. This will be successful enough and will be enough. And I also didn't like to give talks. I didn't like standing anywhere. I didn't like the work needed to create presentations. But when you think of it, that it's sharing knowledge, becoming better yourself, becoming better at a lot of different skills, and changing your perspective why you're doing talks, what you want to achieve and what you can learn while you give the talk, then you start improving.
Welcome to the Growth Show. What keeps us driving is what drives you further. This is your hosts, Sebastian Kunz
and Sarah Kaya.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this week's episode of The Growth Show. We are very, very excited to have Sebastian Vashnik here. Sebastian is the CTO of Axel Springer Ideas Engineering, and he's going to join us for this week's session. Sebastian, thanks so much for your time.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Now, Sebastian, if you connect the dots, growth in yourself, how would you describe this?
I would describe it as growth is very important for me and myself. So I actually started as an electrical engineer, worked in a mining facility, tried out some software development, became obsessed with software development, moved to Berlin, joined a software engineering company, tried to become an even better software developer. So growth and trying out new stuff was always very important for me. And nowadays, it's more like going to the bright side of my skill sets, so not deeper, more wider and brighter. So for example, looking into what makes good engineers, also like soft skills and culture. And so I'm trying to grow. So I would even say if I would be stuck in a job and could not grow anymore personally, I would change my company or my job, whatever.
Mm-hmm. That's actually pretty interesting from the recruitment point of view, but we'll dig deeper to that point later on. You're the CTO of Axel Springer Ideas Engineering. What led you to the CTO role?
Well, actually, my personal growth. So when I was just an engineer, there was always a need for first a project manager, project lead, team lead, and later somebody who handled architecture, HR, and other stuff. And I was always interested in all these kind of topics. I took on new tasks. So I actually was the CTO before I had the title, because I just grew into that role.
You just mentioned soft skills and culture. Can you dig a bit deeper into this? Because I think you had to learn a lot of soft skills. You had to deal with many, many different cultures. So I think it would be very interesting to get some more input.
Yeah, so I think when you start your engineering career, it's electrical engineer, software engineering, whatsoever, it's only about hard skills. In university, you learn all the hard skills, you try a lot of stuff. And when you first start as a junior or engineer, junior software developer, you are mostly obsessed with technical skills, learning this new framework, learning this testing stuff, and becoming better with your hard skills. But there's kind of a ceiling you reach at some point. So you can try to become better, learn more programming languages, frameworks and stuff, but you will not become better. So there's a point when you're a senior developer where you will need to obtain more soft skills to become a coach, become better in all these other topics, presenting stuff, to grow as an engineer and a software developer. Because sometimes it's not about I'm the best software developer, but I can tackle the right solutions. And finding the right solutions is always about communication. So a software engineer who sits in front of his PC for 8 hours, he may seem very efficient, but maybe he's not working on the right problems. Maybe he's wasting the time on his PC. Yeah.
Speaking of programming languages, how did you learn your first programming language?
Well, actually, through my cousin when I was, he's 2 years older than me, and he has two brothers. They were all interested in PCs and they had a PC. And he showed me, like, he wrote a little QBasic program where he could access a printer and print whatever he wanted, like a menu plan and stuff. And then he showed me the first commands in QBasic. And then I tried to create my own little games with QBasic. We had computer science at school. totally sucked, so I learned nothing there. And then when I was studying, I thought, yeah, I want to learn more about it. And as electrical engineer, it's not always about the current going to a cable. Modern electrical engineering is a lot of software development. You're programming everything. So even if you have like a big transformator, you actually need to program it nowadays. So yeah, that's it, my first steps.
So how old were you then when you did learn your first programming skills?
I'm not quite sure, 12 or 13 maybe.
Wow.
So it was quite young actually.
Would you say that someone should learn programming early on, or is it also like pretty easy if you're interested in that field to learn it, I don't know, 30 or 35 or whatever?
Well, I think it's pretty easy to learn later on. So especially in Berlin, you have a lot of boot camps where people from other industries, even journalists or other, can do a 3 month program and learn programming. I think it's more about motivation and passion. So I started it because I loved it. And when I was in my 11th and 12th year of school, a lot of my friends also loved software development, and we started programming our own websites, writing little comics and stuff like that, writing plugins for WordPress. Yeah, the standard stuff you start in school, actually. And I think you don't need to learn it in early years. You can learn it later on if you really like it, because you won't ever be a good developer if you do not love software development.
What would you say is a great start for a beginner in terms of what programming language, or what should someone start with if someone out there is interested in learning programming?
Yeah, I loved web development because you see results quite easily. So if you start to develop a WordPress plugin, you need to program, get data, whatsoever, but you can directly see it. So maybe it's not the best quality, but it's the first steps are way easier if you can see in your browser what you are doing. So into getting in this world means HTML, CSS and JavaScript. So starting with a JavaScript framework really helps you. And nowadays you can even learn backend if you know JavaScript.
So this was the easy start into this. But how would you describe, what would you describe as your most difficult task that you had to do as an engineer?
So there were some quite hard projects, but I would say the first half year when I was a Java developer was quite hard for me, because I did C and C++ and SPSS programming for Siemens. And then I thought, yeah, I'm going to do software development, applied at a software developing company in Berlin with 400 employees, only software developers, somehow passed all the tests with as a Java developer for applying as a Java developer without ever having written any Java code. So I started a new job as a Java developer with experience in no frameworks and only in hardware, hardware near software development. And the first 6 months were like, oh my God, what is this? So I read a lot of books and tried to understand and keep up, because I was afraid to get fired, actually. So I would say the first 6 months were super hard because I didn't know any frameworks. I was thinking, yeah, I know programming. I know like 3-4 programming languages. How different could this be, Java development with some frameworks? It turns out it's not about Java as a programming language. It's about knowing all the frameworks which were used in this project. I've never used a framework before, actually. So, yeah, this was really hard.
But this also, in the same time, gave you the opportunity to grow into this role and achieve new stuff.
Yes, that's also what I love about startups. You can do things where you are totally underqualified. And so you can grow way faster. So it's a job that time where we had a lot of projects, a lot of pressure, but no engineers working on the projects. That's the reason why I got hired without being so good, actually. And I could grow very, very fast. So if you're in this zone, so you have this comfort zone, and then the next zone, it only starts if you are a little bit underqualified and they task you more than you can actually achieve. So that's the best zone where you can grow.
Speaking of where you are today, could you share a little bit more about the innovation hub of Germany's biggest publishing company, Axel Springer?
Sure. Actually, there were two companies founded in 2013, Axel Springer Ideas Engineering and Axel Springer Ideas Ventures. Their idea of Axel Springer Ideas Ventures was a typical company builder. They were shut down after only 12 months because it didn't work out within Axel Springer. And the idea of Axel Springer Ideas Engineering was insourcing a lot of the projects we did with external resources. For example, Welt.de, our news website, was completely built at the time with external developers. And also when they started building Bild Plus and Welt Plus, which is the premium content stuff from Axel Springer, so the paywall where you need to pay for articles, it was done only with external resources. So Axel Springer was thinking, okay, we want to be a tech company in the future. We want to make money with tech. And we actually need engineers and stuff. So they thought, let's found a company. And that was Axel Springer Ideas Engineering. So in 2013, we had like 80 employees. Nearly none of those employees worked for Axel Springer before. Mm-hmm. So and then it grew organically, actually.
So what does your daily work look like?
So my personal daily work is about a lot of networking, actually. So Axel Springer is quite decentralized. We have over 200 different brands like Idealo, Meine Stadt, Finanzen.net, Stepstone, Visual Meta with Ladenzeile, also a lot of advertising stuff. There's no like central governance. So if we want to do a project with those companies, I need to talk with them and convince them that we are the right partner to work on their innovation projects. So a lot of stuff I'm doing is working with our different brands, looking into their problems, doing workshops with them, and trying to find out where they need help, where we could help them. And obviously, nowadays you have a war for talent. So it's a lot about recruiting and marketing and showing people that we are the right employer for them. We are the best company to work as an engineer. So giving talks and shaping our culture, also within Axel Springer. I think until the beginning of this year, Axel Springer was saying, yeah, we are a media company. And I was saying, yeah, we are a media and tech company. So fighting the war within Axel Springer, that tech is important. That tech needs a seat at the table at all decisions. That's how my day actually looks. And there are a lot of tasks which come in ad hoc. So sometimes we are quite good at merging and acquisition, so buying companies, investing. And before we invest, we need to do a due diligence. Sometimes they need a techie to look at this tech product. Is it worth like some million of dollars or euros actually to invest into it or not? So then I'm part of the due diligence team and looking at companies where we are thinking about investing or buying.
Speaking of technical due diligence, because I think that's a pretty interesting topic, What are you looking for if you're looking into the technical due diligence? Do we look into the quality of a quote or what you're looking for?
Yeah, I would call it more like an technical due diligence is also product, organization and culture. So we look, do they follow best practices for software engineering? What's their code quality like? Do they have like dead bodies under their carpet? So, for example, one due diligence we did, they had a content management system, which it was actually open source, but they forked it in private 5-6 years ago. And it was like they could not patch it. It was old school and all their stuff was built on top of this content management system. So I was thinking, okay, this is really actually a yellow flag, because maybe we need to invest 1 or 2 million in refactoring if we buy this company, because this is a risk. So this is one thing. The other thing is how good is the code tested? A lot of startups, for example, they can release feature after feature. They're super fast, but it's not scaling quite well because their hosting costs are very high or they don't write any tests. So their speed will not be as fast as they are now in like a year because they don't follow best practices for engineering. That's things we're looking at. And the other thing is, do they do agile development? Do they do a lot with external partners? How does their roadmap look like? Which technologies did they use? Do they know what they're talking about? So especially for blockchain companies, it's a label which every company nowadays claims. if you try to invest in a blockchain company, yeah, you need a blockchain expert, a real expert, to judge if they are worth their money or not. The same is true with machine learning. Machine learning, you need for marketing reasons, machine learning on your data sheet, actually. But then if you look into it, it's a little bit of statistics, but no real machine learning. But to judge this, you need a someone with a lot of knowledge in machine learning.
Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned tech and you mentioned product, but you also mentioned cultural differences. On LinkedIn, you have some articles explaining this topic, but can you maybe deep dive a bit into cultural differences, cultural hacks, and how you started realizing this and acting upon it?
Yeah, it's also part of our culture code and of our vision that we don't make new products because of great technology, or we are not innovative because of great technology, but because we are faster, more flexible, more user-centric, so because of culture. So if you want to be an innovative company, you need the right culture, a culture for innovation. So this is really important. The other thing is, back in the days, you have a pressure for efficiency. So like in 1950, you needed to be more efficient. Don't make failures, don't make errors. You need to just raise the numbers. But nowadays, it's a pressure for innovation. So just tweaking on some points will not help you be a company or having a product in 5 years. And what you need for an innovation or culture of innovation, it's the right mindset, the right people, and a working environment where people can really strive for new stuff. So when we were founded in 2013, Axel Springer was a different place. We were still quite far in the digitalization game, but the culture was still quite hierarchically, patriarchically driven by men, old men over 50, white, without hair. So how do you attract great software engineers in this kind of culture? So we were not part of the holding. There was a plan that we will be like an engineering department within the Axel Springer holding. But they said, okay, the culture is totally wrong. We will not be able to hire the people we want if we just make them part of Axel Springer SE, actually. So we were funded as our own business unit. And from start on, we tried to be engineering driven. We made a lot of mistakes. So just imagine, you take, back in the days, people from classical other companies which only know classical working ways, never worked agile before, never worked self-organized before. Take 80 of those people, throw them into a new company and say, you are now this new agile self-organized company. And you can imagine how good this worked. Not at all. So this is also the reason try it out, a lot of stuff. How can we improve our culture? How do you even form culture? That's also the reason why it's important for us, because it was a long, long road. We made a lot of mistakes. We learned a lot, and we want to try and share our learnings within Axel Springer, with all our business units, and obviously with the rest of the tech company, because we believe in sharing, believe in open source, and giving and taking. Yeah.
So when we are talking of culture, what kind of culture would you say would attract, especially like in a war of talents, developers or engineers?
So first of all, I think it depends. So there is not like one stereotypical engineer. So it depends if you're what problems you have. If you're a startup, you need more like generalists. And there are but also engineers who are highly specialized. For example, Java engineers, they only want to work on Java projects. They don't want to work on front end. They want to work on back end. And there's something in between. And it depends what you need, what projects you have. And so your culture should be depending on that. So, for example, we tackle, as Axel Springer Ideas Engineering, mostly projects which are on the innovative side of the spectrum. So what we need actually are generalists. We're bootstrapping companies, for example. So maybe we're not using Java, we are using Python. And if you only have Java specialists, it will not work. Also, the work within our company, it's a lot about communication and talking. So there are engineers who will not be happy working for us because they will not be able to sit 8 hours on their PC and write code. And this will drive some people insane. We made mistakes and hired such kind of engineers. They were great persons, but they were not happy at us. So you can have a great culture of openness, transparency, and participation, but still you will have people who will not be happy within your company.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to say this first. And what we are looking for are more like generalists, kind of pioneers. So you can think of three kind of people: pioneers, settlers, and town planners, which have different needs and will be happy with different projects. And what we are looking for are pioneers. As I said, we are working on new products for our brands, which don't exist. So our culture is a lot about self-organized work. You're responsible. You don't need to ask anybody. But as I said, it depends on what you're working. For example, if you're working on old school legacy systems or in a banking sector, maybe what we are, so the people we attract will not be happy there, but people who will not be happy within our culture will be happy there because they can work on deepest technical problems 5 days a week, 8 hours a day.
How do you identify these experts, Sebastian? How does your hiring process look like? Because it's very hard to find out how a person actually is in the interview, right?
Yeah, totally. It depends on the role. Normally, we have 3 steps. First is get together. So we meet for an hour, or if the person is not within Berlin, we do a Skype call, and then we tell him about our company. He or she tells us about her experiences, and we try to get a first feeling, could this be a fit or not. Then the second part is we have a coding challenge, or working test. It depends on if we hire an agile coach, a product owner, or a UX designer. So there's always like a small challenge involved. We prefer it on site so that the person can see how it will feel working in our office, how will we feel working within this environment. But we also do it as homework. This includes a review of the work example, where we talk a lot about why did you do this, why did you do that. And then the last step is a talk with mostly our general manager, our HR business partner, and mostly a third person, most of the time me, about conditions and other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Before we hire somebody, we don't do like a yearly planning. So we want to hire 5 people this year. So we don't do this. So if you look into this plan, because within a huge enterprise company like Axel Springer, you need to do yearly plannings. We will have next year the same number of employees as we have now, which is not true. We grow organically. So if we need somebody, if we have more projects than we can tackle, or if we create a new company and lose people because they move to a new company and we need to hire, then we just grow organically. And we have fixed teams. So the team says we need a UX designer, we need a full stack developer, more like a front end developer, more like a back end developer, more like a operations engineer. I don't know what they need. Then we have a metrics where we say, okay, our team has a lot of introverts, we need an extrovert, focus on his technical skills are most important. And then the team gives a number. So they have 10 points and they show, they say for this quadrant, I give 4 points, for the 3. The product owner does it. And most of the time, me and one agile coach do this as well. So as an external view of the team, where we say, okay, for the next hire, it should be from it's a character from the person. It's more important that it fits into the team because the team needs a more extrovert or a more pragmatically or whatever person. And then when we hire, we look at this skill sets. And when we do the first interview, we have a judging sheet with 4 criteria, and you should be able to judge the person by 4 criteria, which is cultural fit. Will he be happy within our culture? Thinking in innovations. So if he likes trying out new stuff, he would be the right candidate. Technical or like hard skills, is he good in what he's doing? And the 4th thing is analytical skills, because our problem domain changes all the time. So you can imagine if you work for a price comparison website like Idealo, or for a job portal like StepStone, or for programmatic advertisement like a media impact company, you have a total different domain and you need fast analytical skills to understand what you're working on. So, and then we say, judge this person. And if only one of our teammates gives a veto, we're not hiring the person.
I'm thinking of, regarding the interview process, from your experience, what is your best or most insightful interview question for developers or engineers?
Yeah, actually, what are you proudest of? Describe your proudest project and why are you so proud of it? And we are always asking about failures. In this context, is most of the time, did you have conflicts with teammates, with your superiors? What was in it? How did you solve it? So this is you don't ask, are you a good team player? So what even most people have problems describing what actually means team player. We're trying to see if how good can he cope with problems? Because the way we work with super flat hierarchy, so we have one general manager who is responsible for all people within our company. So like the flattest hierarchy you can imagine. This also means you have a lot of discussions, a lot of dispute going on. And if you are not good at coping with problems, maybe this could be a hard environment for you.
Speaking of projects you are pretty proud of, what is your project that you are pretty proud of?
So actually there are two, and it's hard to choose one. One is an older project from 2012, I think. I was working on voting software back in the time for the German general elections, and I wrote the module which transmits the voting results from each of the German states to the central bureau of for voting. And it uses different cryptographical stuff, and it's a really cool software with a really cool installer and a really cool UI. And we built it in record time. So we were only three developers and we created it. I never used cryptographic libraries before, and I learned so much in this project, and it's used for a really important use case. So, and this feeling to building something which is used for something the whole country needs in like only so few weeks, this was really, really cool.
Yeah, I mean, building a company that's actually needed and you actually see it in action, I guess, must be very satisfying to see.
Yes.
How did you get that job?
Well, this was the same company I started as a Java developer. So, say, I had a lot of projects for mobility and for the German government. So I also worked for the EU-Rat, built software for them, and for example, voting software for Munich, for Dresden, and for the Saarland, and for the Netherlands. So building software for elections was a huge part of the company.
And your second proudest project?
This was actually with Idealo when we rebuilt their price alerts, because you can imagine price changes or changes in offers, they come in millions, and millions mean 200 to 300 million a day, which comes to 200 events per second. So building a real-time system which can evaluate 200 offer changes a second, and if you need to send out price alerts, it's like a super huge system, and it was fun working in such a real-time environment with a lot of traffic on it.
Did that project have an impact into the user engagement and user growth later on? Do you know that?
Later on, yeah. So what we did was kind of a refactoring and creating it anew with a newer technology. And they had a central Oracle database, which was nearly on the memory limit for the last 3 years, where all offers were stored and all systems were using them. So this is a super huge bottleneck for Idealo. And we decoupled the price alerts from this database and used events and other stuff. So not in the first step, but in the second step, because it made it possible to automate the price alerts. So before, there were a lot of content managers within Idealo, which were saying, okay, this is a real price alert. There was an error. This is not an error. So you can imagine handy cases, for example. So there were a lot of wrong offers where the system thinks this is a mobile phone, but it's not a mobile phone. It's a case for a mobile phone. And so the error rate before was 25%. So they did did manual quality assurance, and then they said, okay, this is a real price alert. So we enabled a lot more price alerts and automation and freed a lot of resources for them.
Pretty impressive.
Yeah, that's awesome. A couple of minutes ago, Zabatsila said, you mentioned that Axel Springer says you're a media company. You say you're a media tech company, but your legacy business is publishing. So it's funny that neither you nor Axel Springer actually said that you're a publishing company, because this already shows how you guys have been evolving and growing internally. How do you see the future of publishing yourself? Do you see there's a future for the classic print, or do you think it's all going to be digital?
It's all going to be digital. So Even Matthias Döpfner, our CEO of the whole Axel Springer Group, says it's about the content, not about the medium you use to deliver the content. So it was newspapers in the past, and it's changing now to the internet, mobile phones, and tablets. So I totally agree. Nowadays, for example, podcasts. So media means we are publishing content. We are a content house. We create high quality content for different user groups, and the channel with where the user gets this content is not that important. It's the most convenient channel. So it was a newspaper in the past, and nowadays it's a podcast, it's audio, it's websites, it's even video. Yeah. So, and I think, so for example, one of our best going brands in the current moment is Business Insider. They're huge, they're growing, they're a media company, but they only have a digital product, but they are still a great product nonetheless.
I think most of the products we consume nowadays is also like nearly totally digital. So I think it's totally a shift from a product which is now, nowadays, whenever you need it, you can get it.
Yes, but still there is a need for printed newspapers. We are still making a lot of money with printed newspapers and the demand is there. So still, there are people who love printed stuff. Yeah, but still, I think it will become less and less, and the numbers say that it's true. Print is declining month by month, even I would say day by day, actually.
Yeah. So I have a statement for you, and I think it is one statement from you, if I'm not wrong. No system without errors, no IT without problems, no project without knowledge. If you don't make mistakes, you don't work. What was your greatest failure and greatest learning of all time so far?
So my greatest learning was that I'm a bad electrical engineer. I actually set the PC of one of my best friends on fire. So actually, I only knew him for like 24 hours. We are best friends now for years. But even after knowing him only for 24 hours, I tried to hot plug my hard disk into his running PC, had an AC adapter, an adapter for his... a current adapter, and while I was under his desk trying to plug in my hard disk in his running PC, I short-circuited his PC and burned in a huge flame his hard disk. And he lost a lot of data. It was in the year 2005. I say sorry every year because his data was not recoverable. He had no backups and stuff, all his early digital images and other stuff. But we still became best friends. And I learned I'm not good with current and electrical stuff. Yeah. And otherwise, greatest learnings of all time. Yeah, that's a hard question. I would say that it does not matter how good you are as an individual contributor. You can be the best 10x engineer. It will not make a team successful. There was one project here at Axel Springer where they took the best engineers they could find, two of my colleagues and me. And I would say there are two of the best software developers I've ever met. They're really, really great. And they said, okay, you're a super important project. You have 3 months working it. We worked, we worked, we worked. And we got done nearly nothing because we were no team. So what I learned is you can take the three best developers on the whole world. If they are not a good team, they will not get anything done. And that's what it was I learned. It's not important how good I am as a person. It's how good I can contribute to a group, how good I can make a team. And that this is way more important than being a 10x engineer. It's more important that I can help my colleagues become better. And this was really hard for me to learn, actually.
But I think it's one of the greatest learnings of all, right? Because, I mean, the team is always one of the most important thing.
Yeah, and also, every team member only does his thing, you will not create a bigger thing. So the sum of its parts, if everybody works together, the sum of its parts will be way bigger than the single contribution from one person.
Yeah, that makes sense. It's also very interesting to hear this from your C-level point of view. I mean, you've been a speaker for quite a while. You speak at many events, both external and internally. What do you think makes a great speaker from your point of view?
So I think having a story to tell is a good start. So I think if you start a talk with a good story, then you can get the audience to engage way deeper in what you're telling them. If you just start with technical stuff, actually you think people have an attention span of 15 minutes, you will lose them. So this is one thing. And the other thing is like the classic stuff you can learn. Working with your voice, working with your body, having a good posture, being self-confident. So this is also part. So this is basic, yeah, hygiene factors. So you need to work on how you stand on the stage. Having a presenter actually helps. So not going back to a laptop, pressing the arrow button for the next slide, because this always looks stupid and interrupts the flow of your talk. This is really important. Yeah, and I think having some surprising elements always helps. So if you do a 1 hour talk and you're just going through your program, you will lose a lot of people because 1 hour is a lot of time. I would say even a 30 minute talk can be quite hard. Sitting there in a warm room with not enough fresh air in it, and you are talking and talking and talking for 30 minutes. So a great speaker surprises his audience and engages with the audience already while he's talking. That's my answer.
Cool. Do you always have a great story to tell when you're having these talks? Do you think you're a great speaker yourself, Sebastian?
So I think if you start, you are great yourself, you are stop being great. Because there's always room for improvement. I was a bad speaker. I didn't like speaking. So I was a typical engineer. I liked working on software. I believed you should be the best in your programming language, the best with your frameworks. This will be successful enough and will be enough. And I also didn't like to give talks. I didn't like standing anywhere. I didn't like the work needed to create presentations. But when you think of it, that it's sharing knowledge, becoming better yourself, becoming better at a lot of different skills, and changing your perspective why you're doing talks, what you want to achieve and what you can learn while you give the talk, then you start improving. And I'm also doing a thing called Working Out Loud, which is a systematic program, 12-week program for networking. And for my first circle I did, this 12-week program is called a circle with 4 or 5 other people, was becoming a better speaker. Because one of my colleagues, he's more like an introvert, great engineer, and then he goes up there, goes to the stage and gives a talk which strips you from your shoes. So it's such a great talk that I was so impressed by his skills, and I was thinking, wow, he's so good. I want to be at least as good as he is. He's like a role model for me. And then I was thinking, okay, how can I become better? And then I tried a lot of different talks, more talks, tried out different stuff, read books. I was at a training for better talks. Yeah, and tried to get better. So I would say I started as a really, really bad speaker, and I became better talk by talk.
So we're coming close to an end. So our last question for you this evening is, if you could have a dinner with someone, who would that be, dead or alive?
Dead or alive. It actually would be a software developer, John Carmack. He developed a Doom, Quake, Wolfenstein 3D. Mm-hmm. And he's also kind of a tricky person, introvert, but I'm so impressed by his work. I read everything I could about the games he created, the code he wrote, and him as a person. And I would love to have a talk with him, how he sees different things about teamwork and other stuff. Because I really love him and his work, but I would be really interested in hearing his opinion, even on this podcast and the things I said on this podcast. I would love to hear his opinion on it.
That's cool. Sebastian, you said so many interesting things throughout this conversation, but I'm trying to wrap this up in a few sentences. So in your early days, you already became obsessed with soft skills and culture and always tried to improve yourself. And what I found very interesting is that you said in university, you only get taught hard skills. You only learn hard skills, and you will reach a ceiling at one point where you will need to develop, where you will need to develop soft skills and grow yourself. And I think that is very, very interesting insights. And in the end, it's always about motivation and passion. You also mentioned that if you want to be in an innovative company, you need an innovative culture. And I think many companies say, yeah, we're a startup, we're innovative, But I think they don't start where it's needed, and that's the culture. So I think your input here was very, very, very valuable. And also when we asked about the future of publishing, you mentioned that it's not about the medium that you use to deliver the content, it's about the content itself. And I think that's a very, very important insight for everyone who sells or offers content online or in print. It's not about the medium you have to use, it's about the content. And if you have a comfort zone. I mean, we've heard this before in many, many personal development books. We've read this, we've heard this in talks. But when you're in a comfort zone, after that, you reach a position where you're underqualified, where you're out of your comfort zone. And that's exactly the room for personal growth and for personal development. Thank you so, so much, Sebastian, for all these insights. It was great having you in the show, and all the best.
Yes, thank you. It was a pleasure.